back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig. How's it going today, Uncle Dig?
It's going pretty good. It's kind of got a, like, Bengals hazy shade of winter vibe. It's, like, overcast and, like, kind of raining, but kind of not. It's a real, like, funky morning.
Yeah, we're having a lot of wind, and it's supposed to get down into the 20s later this week. So winter has not left us here in the Northwest. So storms over the next couple of days, and then that cold Canada air is going to be coming in. And today, to get the show started, Dig and I are going to compare and contrast our medical cannabis card experiences that we've had recently. And I wanted to bring this up, Dig, because I had a heck of a time getting my medical cannabis card this year. My card ended in July. So that's when the my card ended in June. That's when the expiration date was. But, you know, my service provider went out of business, but they didn't tell anybody.
So
it took me like 2 months to find a new provider after trying to figure out where they were, waiting on them to get back to me. So I didn't go and get my medical cannabis card or my appointment until mid-August. Now, this whole time, I am consuming medical cannabis, and I'm out of what's called compliance. So it's making me real nervous. But I finally got in there. That appointment cost me $100.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, it's this weird thing in Washington. Now, this has also moved out across the country, but I believe it started here, that in order to get a medical cannabis card recommendation from a doctor, you have to have what's called a bona fide relationship. So in order for that to happen, that first time you meet that doctor, so you have a relationship, guess what? You got to go back twice, 6 months later. And so after I went to my appointment, I had to go over to the store, had to get them to print me out a little laminated card. So that's your official registration.
Right.
Well, that thing expired on January 1. So I had to go back. Oh, yeah. And then, by the way, that first appointment took me like 3 hours because the people didn't have somebody there to help a blind person fill out the paperwork. And I had to wait for all the people to go through before me, before they could get somebody to have time to come help me do that, okay? So that had already got on my nerves. So then they're like, come back 6 months later. So I go 6 months later, I have to ride the shuttle. It takes forever to ride that thing. They drop me off, leave me there, go in, pay them $70 for a less than 5 minute appointment. That's our relationship. They get the money, have to go back outside, wait. Finally get home, another 3 hour trip, and I'm still not done. I still got to make it over to the store and get registered.
Right.
So I'm still not done with the process of getting a medical cannabis card. Something, as I mentioned before, I've been consuming medical cannabis since I was 19 years old. I've been searched by police. I have been pulled over in roadblocks. I've had all kind of problems and benefits from cannabis. And I still have to go through this absurd process to get this card. And it's all made up by the Washington State Legislature. It's just
this crazy
system.
What do you mean register at a store?
Well, in Washington State, you have to be on what's called a registry. So once you go get the card, once you go get what's called an authorization, then you have to go to another step. You have to go to the store and do what's called a registration. So that's where they take your picture, put you on a card, put you in a Washington State database, which, by the way, the DEA has access to.
What a nightmare.
And police can also get subpoenas for that registration if they feel like they have an investigation. So I would just like to congratulate the state of Washington for really almost turning me off from getting a medical cannabis card. And I had to stop. And since I'm on this little rant here, I just want to say, too, I had to stop my indoor grow, Dig, because there's nowhere to get plants for medical cannabis patients in Washington State. And I know I'm getting a little fired up here, but this is my original medical cannabis card was I just went into this place. Okay, sir, they talked to me. The dispensary was literally right next door.
Right.
I did that for like 4 years before they shut it down and they changed the law. So
right.
Washington State has a big problem with medical cannabis. Many people say we don't even have a medical cannabis system, and I'm starting to agree with them. Let's compare and contrast Dig's medical cannabis experience.
So the OMMP program, the Oregon Health Department, sent me a letter in February reminding me, or maybe it was January, was like late January. They sent me a letter reminding me that my OMMP card, my medical, I don't like calling it medical marijuana, but that's what the state calls it. And for clarity, that's why I'm calling it the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, because that's what they've chosen to call it. I don't like calling things marijuana. We've talked about that on the show before. Anyway, they sent me a letter. Hey, you're going to expire in March. I'm like, okay. So then a couple of weeks later, they send me all the form that I need to fill out and mail back to them to re-register. And so you go through the form, and since I grow here at my place for myself, I don't have to report anything I grow here to Metric. So that's one fee waived. And then since I'm a veteran, I don't have to pay a grow site registration fee. So that's another fee waived. And last year, the Oregon legislature changed the law to where if you're a veteran and can show proof of permanent disability, they'll waive your need to see a doctor. So that used to cost me $175 to see the pot doctor so I could get my medical card, because the VA won't give you recommendations, obviously, because they're federal. So I had to spend that money to get the recommendation. Now I don't have to do that. That's another fee waived. And then there's like a $20 gross site registration fee that I also don't have to pay, and a medical registration fee that I don't have to pay because of my veteran status. So I filled out all this paperwork, went to the library and got copies of my veteran paperwork so I could attach to the packet, mailed it in, and then within a week and a half, I had my new medical cards for free. And that was it. Just all by mail, like really quick. Filled out a couple forms, printed some stuff out, and mailed it in, and then they gave me my new cards. And then I just have to keep the card displayed here, like the letter from the card displayed. I keep it displayed on my fridge so that if anyone wants to come inspect my grow site, I have it displayed at the grow site. This is a grow site. And then I just grow. I don't have to register anywhere. I'm already registered. I assume the DEA has access to this, but I don't think we're a high priority for enforcement.
No. And, you know, I know the DEA has access to us, and I know the police have access to us, but I don't feel like they're going to come investigate me or anything. But they will. We know that they investigate black and brown people more, and we do know that they do use these things for investigations. So, you know, I feel like the registration is a bit much, but they've been wanting to kind of crack down on it. But I feel like everybody should have a process similar to your experience there in Oregon. You know, you have that first visit with your doctor. Okay, sir, you have a disability. Okay, ma'am, you're a veteran. Okay. Then after that, just every year, you just kind of go through the process via mail, because many people with disabilities, those disabilities don't go away. So it's just right. Strange that we have to keep going back over and over again for the same thing on a substance that is literally one of the least harmful substances out there in the environment for you to consume.
Right. And a lot of people in Oregon don't get their medical card because it is kind of expensive if you're not a veteran or you don't have certain qualified disabilities. There's also a low income element that I've never really explored. I think if you're on certain federal assistance programs, like if you're on Social Security, I think you also get a discount on some of those fees. But I didn't look into that currently because they don't apply to me. One of these days on my other podcast, The Bagseat Chronicles, I may go in depth on a couple of states' different medical programs. But Oregon's medical program, to be honest, just like a lot of them, is kind of convoluted. But whereas Washington's is convoluted in a way that makes it dangerous and kind of legally perilous to be a patient, Oregon's kind of makes it hard to prosecute anything because it's so vague. Does that make sense? Oregon's medical law seems to err on the side of the patient, whereas Washington seems to err on the side of law enforcement overly restricting the plant. I don't know what you call it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's what that all was designed into the law, SB 5052, the Cannabis Patient Pain and Suffering Act, as I call it. But that all came out in 2015, and so it was built into the law to make the system restrictive. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but I want to get on to our news. And I just wanted to let you and the audience know, Dig, that we have a guest coming on later. Bailey Hirschberg of Washington State Normal is going to be joining us to talk about cannabis in Washington and some other things going on, including some things about cannabis in the media. So stay tuned. And now, let's check the news.
This is a Cannabis Sativa Special Report.
And our first news story is something that's been out there for a couple days, and that is Twitter is going to start having cannabis advertising. And that's for THC, CBD, and what it said in the article, parentheses, CBD M-cannabinoids, which I take to mean Delta 8, THCO, and all these other cannabinoids. So now Twitter will start having advertising. You got to jump through some hoops to get on there. But it's interesting that they're the first social media site to really jump into this.
Yeah. I think they're going to have some problems. At first, when we first started talking about this, I kind of thought this was irrelevant, and I kind of still want to think that, but the more I think about it, the thing that makes this interesting, right, is the legal question, right? Twitter isn't limited by state borders, right? It's an international network, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're advertising on this international network, how are you complying with state laws? How are you complying with federal law? How are you complying with international law or other sovereign countries' advertising laws? So it opens up a real big can of worms for Twitter, and I'm actually kind of interested to see if this devolves into just a crazy legal battle fairly quickly.
Yeah, and our friend Dr. James McCray mentioned on Facebook that Twitter is also used by a lot of kids, and that kids are going to be looking at cannabis advertising in schools. They're going to be looking at cannabis advertising at home. And then they're going to have more access to these products because of the advertising. And I feel that that is also going to be a problem for Twitter once more light is shined on cannabis being marketed to people that are underage. All right, our next story is down in San Diego, and this is a case where the state is handing out social equity grants. And the first thing I want to mention on this is that I feel like this is a good thing in the fact that it's helping a lot of Black and Brown, Indigenous, and Latino people get into the cannabis industry. However, when you look at this, it's not a ton of money. San Diego got $880,000, and the whole state, $16 million, went to 15 cities, which when you spread that all around, it's not a ton of money to help people.
Yeah, I agree with you, Lucas, and part of this is due to California's Byzantine and frankly extortionate licensing system. It would be more effective to just out and out waive these fees for these equity grants or these equity applicants and just give them the license rather than giving them money through these grants, which is only like fattening the pockets of nonprofits and isn't even enough to pay for as many licenses as the state could just grant by fiat.
Yeah, it's just kind of like a little boost. And a lot of people are going to be left hanging, not being able to make it all the way. And then the money's going to run out in 2 years. And as we talked about on the show before, the cannabis industry is shrinking. And it's really odd, and people have remarked on this, that now that the cannabis industry is starting to flounder a little bit, and the same here in Washington, you know, now they're starting to award these social equity grants. So now that people have been left behind because of the drug war, lack of capital, and just the fact that, like here in Washington, they were really oppressive on Black and Brown folks in the medical cannabis industry trying to get into the recreational cannabis industry.
Right.
on to our next story, and this is a story that we've covered before. We're just kind of bring the audience up to date on this, and it's a couple of one of the people were from Illinois, and there was a man from Georgia, and they did like this $650 million cannabis and cattle Ponzi scheme. It's just crazy. I would say first that anybody that comes and tries to invest, do cannabis investments with you named Frog Martin to say, hey, I might not want to do this right now. But the penalties on this. So they only got 6 years in prison. They stole $650 million.
Oh, my.
And they got 6 years in prison. You get busted a pound of weed in some parts of this country, you're going to get more than 6 years.
Oh, my Lord.
And they don't even have to pay back all the money.
You know, and honestly, besides this right now, like, I would just say, like, it's not a good time to invest in legal cannabis right now. The market is in turmoil. People are desperate for investors, but wholesale prices for the actual plant aren't sticky. They're fluctuating a lot from year to year, and the legal producers have trouble growing good cannabis, which everyone is starting to forget is what cannabis companies sell. Everyone gets lost in these advertising and, you know, market share, et cetera, et cetera. And no one bothers to grow good cannabis, and they all wonder why these brands are tanking. It's a really bad time to invest in cannabis right now if you expect reasonable return at a level of risk that is acceptable to, I would say, 95% of investors.
Yeah, and you really want to make sure, just like when we're talking about when you're a consumer, that you go and actually research the brand and what you are investing in. So these folks were just giving money to this couple just hand over fist, and it doesn't look like they even went and checked on what they were trying to invest in.
Look at the cows that you're buying. It sounds like these people were trading in cattle they never went and saw.
Yeah.
Yep. Which is a horrible idea. And with cannabis and investing in all of this stuff, like, you should grow cannabis or participate in the cannabis culture because you love cannabis and love the people, not because you want to get rich. Cannabis is not a good way to get rich right now.
So our last story, and this is an update again on some things that we're talking about, and that is about Delta 8 and something called THCO, and there's a couple other THCs that are synthetic cannabinoids. And these are made from CBD, where they put it through an extreme chemical process and make these substances. And apparently they're for sale all over the place, just right in the stores. And the DEA, somebody wrote them a letter and say, hey, DEA, is this stuff illegal? The DEA came back with a letter and said, yes, but there's no way to enforce it, and they're not really going to do anything about it.
Right. So the DEA and the FDA have really been doing a poor job regulating cannabis. We talked about the FDA failing to regulate some derivatives, I think, last episode.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're talking about the DEA saying some stuff, but then, you know, not doing anything about it. But I think it's important for people to remember that anytime we have a loophole like Delta 8, any of these derivatives, like, it's just a matter of time before law enforcement or the state or whoever figures out a way to close these loopholes. The only way we really are going to make lasting change is by legalizing cannabis and reducing law enforcement interaction with cannabis patients.
Yeah, because the Delta 8 craze came from they had an overproduction of hemp CBD. They needed something to do with this, and so they came up with a way, and I think they already knew how to do this since the 1960s. But they had all this CBD sitting around. They're like, well, what are we going to do with this? Somebody said, oh, we can make this Delta 8. It's a loophole. Boom, there you go. Right. And I have an interesting story about this THCO. I have a friend of mine who's a medical cannabis activist, and I've heard of people using the THCO. And I have a person I know in Alabama gets it because they can't get THC, just like you mentioned. There's not – it's hard to get regular cannabis sometimes, but you can just order this stuff online.
Right.
Well, I had a friend here in Washington State that was interested in the THCO. So he went and bought some online. It was hemp flower sprayed with THCO. He went and found two volunteers, told them what he was doing. These were two people that were dabbers. They dabbed a lot, so they had a really high THC tolerance.
Right.
Said, hey, fellas, try this. Sat them down, gave them a bowl. This stuff smoked it. Knocked them out.
Oh, dang.
They were like, wow. I mean, it really messed them up. And they were like, oh, what we did wrong was we didn't know how to dose it. So they just put like a whole bud in the pipe, smoked it like they would regular cannabis.
Right.
And just, they had a really bad experience with it. So this is another thing where the loophole and the government not actually providing real cannabis has led to all these synthetic cannabinoids, which are causing health problems out there in the United States.
Yeah, folks, don't smoke synthetic cannabis. Like, a lot of these compounds we really don't understand to the degree that we understand, you know, THC, THCA, CBD, CBG, et cetera, right? And so maybe if you're going to experiment with cannabis, just experiment with cannabis and don't risk your health with spice or Delta 8 or THCO, which, to be honest, Lucas, I'm like pretty deep into the cannabis, you know, space. And this is the first time anyone's really mentioned THCO was me preparing for this show. I had never heard of it before this.
Mm.
Yeah, so like they're coming up with new compounds all the time.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Advocates for Medical Cannabis. Learn more about this organization at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com. And we are back for this week's interview. And this week we are joined by Bailey Hirschberg. And Bailey is a board member of Washington State Normal. He is also a writer and reporter over at the Cannabis Observer. How are you doing today, Bailey?
I'm doing real great, Lucas. Thank you so much for having me.
Wanted for you just to take a minute and introduce yourself and tell us what you are doing in the world of cannabis right now.
I got into cannabis policy and the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws at the University of Missouri, Columbia in 2004 after I found the Just Say No policy wasn't working. I interned for Normal in the Drug Policy Alliance, and I volunteered on a lot of cannabis campaigns, and that led me to being a volunteer organizer for I-502. So since legalization, I've, you know, kind of been on and off with Normal, but for the last, you know, several years, I worked with them, including as a part-time consumer lobbyist in 2017 and 2018. And then after that, I started working for a small newsroom called Cannabis Observer. So my main job is to record, observe, and summarize public meetings for the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board, and sometimes our legislature, some other bodies. And then we publish the audio. Sometimes we summarize, sometimes we just do some supportive, you know, documents and materials about it. And we try to be a resource for anyone that wants to track, you know, really for the last half decade, cannabis policymaking in Washington. And I also sometimes show up and tell the LCB or lawmakers myself what I think might, you know, help cannabis consumers in our state.
Yeah, and thank you so much for your activism. And I'm a big fan of the Cannabis Observer. I've noticed this year that it's been really hard to find Washington State bills via just the Google process. I don't know if they changed their website or something, but it's been really hard to find information on bills and everything. So I've actually been using the Cannabis Observer way more this year because it's been one of my only ways to find some of those bills, which seem to kind of get buried.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned 502 there, and I'm just going to jump right into it. You said you were a organizer with the 502 campaign, and there was a bit of criticism while it was going on that it didn't have the home grows, and a lot of patients were a little nervous about 502. And I voted for 502 because I'm from a prohibitionist state in the South, and I really feel like we should have legal cannabis. But I'm also a medical cannabis patient. Now, I believe I would still vote yes, but, you know, there's been a little criticism of 502. As someone who organized on 502, what is some of your thoughts on where Washington State policy is currently right now in 2023?
Well, if there is to be a brave new world, our generation is going to have the hardest time living in it. That's, I'm a movie nerd, and so that's kind of a mangled Shakespeare quote. Got used in an old Star Trek movie. But I sometimes think about it when I'm kind of contemplating how legalization has gone so far and where we started in Washington. You know, there are clear positive results. You know, almost no possession arrests, down from more than 1,000 a year, and evidence that those were really not proportionally applied. Money that would have gone to organized crime has been reduced, and in some cases might have been eliminated. And then, I'm not sure where in the South you're from. I grew up in Southeast Missouri. And, like, we got states this week, Oklahoma voted on legalizing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they voted against it, but they're voting on it.
Right.
And medical's become a huge deal there. And places like my home state of Missouri just voted to legalize. And so I feel like, in the sense of starting a nationwide, not just conversation, but actual trend in changing policies, that, you know, I-502's had some really good results. And some of those are directly for Washington, and some of them are just kind of for the broader movement in the nation. But obviously there's tons of difficulties for people who enjoy cannabis recreationally, people who need it as a medicine, and people who just want to make a living, you know, in the market. And then there are difficulties for the other people who, you know, don't fall into those groups and now have to recognize that our needs and our ambitions are just as valid, when they didn't really have to, you know, pay attention to that 10 years ago. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for that last group that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But recognizing that political change is going to be long and it's a difficult path for everyone. So I'm kind of okay with where we are, but I want more, because it's a brave new world, but it's still hard to live in it sometimes.
Yeah, I was surprised, and not necessarily surprised, that Oklahoma did not pass their recreational cannabis law. And then Missouri, you know, that's really a shot across the bow there in the South. I'm from Alabama and spent a lot of time in Florida. And Florida's actually about to try to legalize it, too. I'm not sure what's going to go on with that in 2024. But there has been a lot of movement of cannabis in Florida and in the South. And then Missouri, you know, like I was telling people, if you could invest in a gas station or something on the route between Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida to Missouri, then you're probably going to be sitting pretty well, because that is kind of like Colorado legalizing back in 2012 in the Southwest. Now look at the Southwest, New Mexico, Arizona, all the way around it. So, yeah, the 502 was the originator right there with Colorado, and there has been some hang-ups on it. But overall, it has been a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely in favor of it. Obviously, we would have – I don't know a lot about the Oklahoma initiative, so maybe it's not my place to say, gosh, this was good or bad policy. You like to see this stuff expand. You like to see them moving away from prohibition. But at the same time, you know, just seeing these votes in places like the Dakotas, like Oklahoma – I know Florida, I believe they have a threshold of 60% on some of their votes. And my understanding is that's really, you know, it's difficult, sure, certainly for anything, but definitely for cannabis. And, you know, would be great to get some more friends and some more allies in that state's government. But we'll hope that this continues, because we're continuing to evolve, and there are, you know, other states that are going to be changing these policies, you know, for years.
So let's bring it back here to Washington. Washington does not have home grows, and this year there was a big hope that home grows would pass. Actually made it right to where it made it last year in the House Appropriations Committee and stopped. Do you have any insight on why that might have happened this year, in a year that everybody kind of thought that it might make it through?
Well, I mean, I think one of the reasons that I thought would make it through is this was a pretty conservative proposal as far as home grows go. During I-502, the lack of home grow, you know, was a really big complaint. Patients have it under certain conditions. But, you know, adults are allowed to possess and to buy this product, but the moment they start planting a seed, well, a little after the seed, I guess, starts sprouting and they have this plant, it's a felony. Can even be two felonies, because you have the maintaining a premises where drug production or something, you know, there's essentially a second charge. And that just kind of depends on whether they want to prosecute you. So I mentioned being a consumer lobbyist for Normal. Our state chapter had a little bit of money, was able to pay me part time. And this was back in 2017. And it was something that I really put some energy into. And even then, couldn't get it past to an appropriations hearing. Since then, patient John Kingsbury has really been working diligently on it.
Mm-hmm.
And has worked it several years, and worked with legislative leaders. And the bill was House Bill 1614. And as I said, it had tagging requirements for the plants. It had a lot of limits on what their odor or visibility, you know, ability for to be seen or smelled in a public space. It created a civil infraction labeled community endangerment, and it was around proving youth had access to this. And it was based on a gun storage provision, and it was stricter than the gun storage provision, because the law that it was based on essentially said, well, yes, you know, the child can be in the presence of this if they have the permission of the guardian and they're, you know, with an adult at the time, you know, for educational stuff, and I guess maybe demystifying questions that a kid might have about a firearm. And my testimony was kind of, well, why wouldn't we want that same educational opportunity for something far less deadly, you know, these cannabis plants? So I had a couple of suggestion changes, but I thought it was pretty conservative and pretty good. And it was really, really disappointing, because it got bipartisan support in what's called its policy committee. And then in the second one, which is this appropriation, which was a fiscal committee hearing, a lot of people noticed that the legislative staffer who talked to the committee about this threw out a hypothetical impact on cannabis retail sales, really out of nowhere. And that's kind of a no-no if you're not the one who's writing an analysis for an agency. You know, if you're writing that analysis, sometimes those hypotheticals can be added. But when they're not present, I'm not sure I would say it's verboten, but it's a faux pas or a no-no.
Yeah.
For the committee staff to say, hey, he called it an illustrative example, because he's not saying, oh, we think this will or won't happen, because this guy would have no idea. And so it was, I don't know if it was an incompetence of this person was like, oh, I'm helping by throwing out this idea, or if it was a deliberate effort to sow doubt and there was an effort for that, you know, person to bring that up. But once the home grow bill stopped, a lot of people really felt like that was an additional detail that kind of poisoned the well on lawmakers considering it. But I do want to say that the bill cannot advance for the rest of 2023, but it will technically exist and be at the place that it is, which is this appropriations committee hearing in 2024. So if people want to be talking to their lawmakers, you know, throughout the year about House Bill 1614, there's still a chance that it can move. And so that's disappointing. It won't be this year. But I do want folks to stay engaged with that, because we've had cannabis bills that moved part of the way the first year and then were passed the second and became law. Not a lot, but one comes to mind. So I would hope people will stay interested in that and continue to talk about that as legislation and an issue.
So another topic I wanted to speak with you about is the idea of cannabis social consumption lounges. And there have been a couple places that have started these up, and a lot of people in Washington feel like this is something that make a big difference here in the state for a variety of reasons. So what's going on with that front with the social consumption lounges around the country?
Well, I've been looking into this for several years, and I got into it a little more seriously last year, actually almost exactly a year ago, in presenting some information to the Washington State Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force. Well, a work group within that task force that was looking at licensing options. And when I started doing that, I was kind of surprised how many states had pursued this. A kind of disclosure about the progress we've seen on lounge policy just in other states. With COVID-19, a lot of state programs were slowed or put on the back burner.
Mm.
But there are several states like California, I think has somewhere between 10 to 18 or so that may be active. One is called the Original Cannabis Cafe. There's one in Las Vegas called Nuwu Cannabis Lounge. And it's actually said to be the largest such lounge in the United States right now. And that one is tribally owned. But it sounds like there are starting to be a few dozen locations in places like Alaska and Michigan and Illinois, and frankly, not just the places you might expect like Las Vegas and California, that are really looking at this and putting policies in place. And then there are lots of other places that have kind of bring your own bud type private clubs where they're not a dispensary, but they're a private, venue that a state, doesn't consider to be a public space, is age restricted and stuff. One's called like Tetra Lounge in Denver, for example. It looks to me like the majority of legal cannabis states have either started some kind of lounge policy, have temporary event permitting, or are even designating public spaces for cannabis consumption. So I've been talking with the LCB and a couple lawmakers about why those policies need to change. In 2019, I worked to author and get sponsored a bill that didn't go anywhere, but was the first proposal for lounges and for social use in Washington state. This year we've had the first cannabis hospitality bill, House Bill 1822, that officially has died, and much like the home grow bill could come back next year, but isn't advancing right now. And all really it was allowing people who are like short-term renters on Vrbo or Airbnb or something to offer someone a complimentary joint as part of their booking or their rental. And part of the reason was they found out this was already happening with alcohol and cannabis anyway, and that people doing it might be breaking the law. But at the same time, it's still their private property. It's the only place in Washington where people are allowed to consume cannabis is in a private residence. So it was a really kind of small toe in the water for thinking about this. And my comment at the time was, aside from our stores, Washington isn't that hospitable a place to be a cannabis consumer. No one considers us to be a leader in this field, the way we are when it comes to, producing it and selling it.
Yeah, and I just had a friend of mine today post on Facebook, and he was really serious. Like, hey, I want to go to a park and have a smoke out. And that is something that it kind of sparked my mind, because used to be when cannabis was illegal, people would like leave their home, go out and get it, and then you'd have to go find one to consume it, because you couldn't necessarily consume it at home or around your house because it's illegal. So you
it was
would
a
go.
Lord of the Rings hike to some place where you just weren't going to get discovered and could.
Yeah, so you would go to the park and outside and somewhere. We would like ride dirt roads or go find back roads and all kind of places.
Yeah, and then you're in cars and using pot, and now that's everyone's favorite thing.
Yeah, but you just couldn't. But now you have to be at home. And I think my point was, it's like way more social because you were going out with people.
Yeah.
Now, like you mentioned, the only place you could consume cannabis is at your house. And we all consume cannabis at our house with other people, but it's not it doesn't seem as social as it used to be when it was more on the underground market. Yeah. And it's kind of a weird flip around there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a very social substance. And also, it's kind of like when you were taking the risk of arrest, then, anyone who would pass a joint to you was kind of a friend in a foxhole.
Yeah.
And whether or not that makes things seem more appealing because they're taboo or you're taking risks or something, it created a lot of bonding opportunities. And so I think we're missing that. I don't tend to think that cannabis consumption by oneself is like the most healthy primary avenue. I tend to think like you, it's, you know, better with friends or family, with acquaintances who agree and who are okay with, you know, whether it's an edible or a beverage or a smoked product. I mentioned John Kingsbury's work on the Homegrow Bill, and that included getting arrest data that showed that the inequalities that we saw based on race for possession arrests for cannabis was apparent for arrests for small cannabis grows, 6 plants or less. He was looking at this specifically in relation to the bill. It's not that they're quite categorized by that like that. He made a strong case to the Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force to recommend legalizing home grows and to try to expunge past state level convictions for that, at least small level activity. I think lounges and events could help people using our social equity program start a business, but there are a lot of expenses, I'm imagining, to do that right. And it's a lot less certain for new businesses that they'll want to take that on. So more and more, I've felt that your ability to consume cannabis in Washington relates directly to your level of social privilege. And my examples, Bill Gates will always be able to find a place to enjoy weed.
Mm-hmm.
His own property, just about anywhere would welcome him if he wanted to pull out a doobie and start smoking. And the fine that he might get would be functionally pocket change to him. Because it's a citable fine. A far poorer person in public housing is going to be barred from consuming cannabis in their home.
Yep.
Maybe in a rental agreement, too. Kind of depends. And this makes smoking on street corners their best option, even though a citation with that fine might be a lot worse, you know, for them to try to fit into their budget and their life. Now, I feel like there are people who complain or judge neighborhoods where there's public cannabis use that otherwise would look pretty similar to affluent areas.
Mm-hmm.
It's just outside.
Yeah.
And so I'm starting to wonder more and more if the most equitable approach for consumers is focusing on changing our state's designated smoking area laws, our indoor smoking laws, to include cannabis where we can and start giving people any public option.
Yeah, that is similar. I think New York did that. They had it where you could consume at the fair because they changed the law where you could smoke cannabis. Anywhere you can smoke cigarettes, you can light up a joint too. There was some pushback on that, but I think it ended up standing. And I'm glad you mentioned the Social Equity and Cannabis Task Force and how home grows and these social consumption clubs could improve social equity in our state, because it is a big problem with African Americans, black and brown folks getting into the industry. But not only that, the police and the arrest is all flipped around too. So I'm really glad you mentioned that there.
Well, and I want to throw out one idea. I'd love to see some version of it here in Washington. I was surprised to see a good public use for cannabis law coming from Connecticut.
Okay.
And what Connecticut's program said was, if your city whose population is over, I think it's 50,000. That's not a huge state, not a ton of places. I think there were 19 or 20 jurisdictions that applied to. But basically the law said, if you want a cannabis store there, and you want to be collecting revenue from that, you have to give a public consumption space. That a big city can't just pull in the money and the business from it and not provide any sort of public consumption option. And so I ended up talking to a patient who lived over that way and kind of explained that I thought that was a cool idea. And he tells me, you're not missing much. He goes, the place that I know that does it, it's an empty sidewalk next to an empty field. There's not a bench. There's not a gazebo. And I told him, you know, I'm over here in Washington State, one of the first places to legalize cannabis, and I have to be jealous of your empty sidewalk, you know, in Connecticut somewhere, because that just shows that they are making any attempt to fit that in to their social and civic fabric. And we don't have that in Washington, at least not yet.
I want to move on to another topic, and that is this idea of the interstate commerce of cannabis. And we know that federal legalization is coming at some point. But this legislative session, they had a trigger bill that said if that happens, that automatically California, Oregon, and Washington would start go ahead and trading cannabis. What are your thoughts on this? Do you think this will help or hurt the industry as far as social equity, small farmers, or how do you think this will affect the cannabis industry?
It could certainly help Washington businesses, and particularly the producers. You know, the idea of opening up these markets, you know, they can't even sell from their own premises. You know, their entire outlet is through agreeable retailers. So opening up these other states would be a real boon.
Yeah.
And there certainly are women and minority owned producers, but frankly, not that many. So I don't have an objection to an interstate commerce bill, and I get it and I like it, and I think it pushes the idea of, again, you know, a more social market on this. It pushes that goal further, or it furthers that. But because what they're proposing relies on federal action that I haven't seen being on the horizon, even after a decade, I don't really see this as a quick fix for the industry. And I don't see it as doing a ton for consumers right now, because we have decent product variety in a lot of these stores. So, you know, I was thinking like Cali Weed might be fire, but we're getting by without importing. So that, you know, I certainly want to help businesses and would be supportive of stuff that's helping some of these guys make more. Another thing I would be supportive of is, you know, lowering our state income taxes. I'm sorry, not income, our state excise taxes that we level 37% on cannabis on top of then a local sales tax wherever it's being sold. And actually see that tax go down a little bit, but if prices could stay the same and get a little bit more back towards the producers, you know, that's would certainly be an outcome I'd support.
There's been a lot of it's 2023. We have so many states of recreational cannabis, medical cannabis is spread all the way across the country, but we still have this negative view of cannabis in the media and out there and popular culture. Can you just talk a minute about how the media and their portrayal of cannabis sort of affects cannabis policy overall in the United States?
I mean, like I said, I'm a big movie and TV nerd, so this is kind of an aspect of pop culture I will think about constantly. And when you look at the timeline of how media has been used around cannabis policy, it doesn't even all go back to the movie Reefer Madness in the 1930s, because there had been prior anti-cannabis films before that, even in the silent film age. But that's really an inflection point where it's put forward as almost a pseudo documentary or a based on true stories tale. And we know Reefer Madness now, but its original name was Tell Your Children. So, you know, using media to further cannabis policy and cannabis messaging is about as American as apple pie. And when you go from the kind of messaging of that and the prohibition and almost kind of temperance era attitude to like Cheech and Chong in the 70s, the TV show Weeds in the aughts, and then like I'm a huge fan of the franchise Stranger Things, which really made weed a plot point last year without entirely resorting to the stoner cliches. So because it's an homage show to the 80s, we did get a few, you know, of that. So I wanted to give kind of a shout out to Eduardo Franco, who played the character Argyle on the show. That guy's really been killing it as a stoner character actor in stuff like American Vandal and the movie The Binge. And there was another character on a CBS sitcom called Ghosts. There's a 1960s hippie ghost named Flower, who died while trying to hug a bear on some kind of drug trip. And she's just kind of perpetually high as a spirit. And she's played by Sheila, I believe it's Carrasco. And she's a little bit of a trope, but they do some sweet storylines with her too. And her cannabis affinity isn't just like, this is the moral failing, this is what's wrong with this person, you know, were they not, you know, having ever smoked cannabis, you know, at this point back in the 60s. And then another character, Michelle Hurd's character Rafi on Star Trek Picard, is presented as someone who has a lot of substance problems. And that included vaping something called snake leaf, which we don't quite learn about. But I just think it's kind of fun to see this coming up in characters and concepts that aren't just stoners or losers, drugs are bad or they're bad people. And there's a lot of good cannabis media around if you look for it.
Yeah, it's slowly changing, but there has been a lot of cannabis, negative cannabis media in like the news media. I mean, I appreciate that the popular culture is sort of changing.
But yeah,
News media really has been on this, and I think they're behind the popular culture, though. You know, they are still trying to stir up the reefer madness, but the popular culture is kind of seeing where the they're reading the tea leaves, and they're saying, "Hey, this is more acceptable than a lot of people in the media or other outlets might think."
Yeah, and I mean, that's still, you know, part of it is there continue to be a lot of federal restrictions on broadcast and on media and on the content. And so there are degrees to which, you know, you can't literally show a person smoking cannabis. So you tend to see in the media part of a person's face, you know, their lips and chin, so that we're not incriminating them. Or maybe the only time it's been done really well was with teenagers on that 70s show, where they have this camera device of it spinning around the joint circle, but the joint is never there. You know, it's this unseen character. And I know that's pop culture again versus the media, but, you know, part of it is not just the reaction of, oh, this is legal. You know, for a while it's a novelty that it's legal. But now it's to the point that, oh my gosh, they want to be treated like equals in other ways. You know, we talk about home grower social use, but it also comes up on housing and jobs and employment and what education options or even offerings that colleges have around cannabis. And I think the intent of some people, whether they were prohibitionists or not kind of before legalization, was that, well, we won't arrest you, but we should never have to see or hear it.
Yeah.
Was that there's a social agreement that you do it, but, you know, keep your head down. And it was, you know, I'm more or less straight, but it seems reminiscent to me of eras of the way gay rights movement and the homosexual community or the LGBTQI community would be treated, where it's like, oh, well, we're not condemning you for that, but, you know, keep it at home, and we don't want to see t-shirts, and now we don't want to see drag shows, and not to jump to some other hot button topic. But I think there's certainly degrees between criminalization and acceptance. And so we're still definitely on that spectrum when it comes to the news media.
Yeah, and that could be Oklahoma right there in a nutshell, where they're saying, okay, we're okay with this sort of, but you guys have put it in our face a little too much.
And we're going to stop it right here. For patients, if you look sick enough, if a passing observer deem your disability visible enough, then, you know, then I won't arrest you. But if not, then it's, you know, and there was kind of this era with medical where that was the attitude, was that, no, it's, you know, there's one really sick person and the rest, you know, I don't really want to even articulate that too much because it's been a really negative, really lingering assumption in some aspects of society. I found it almost never true. And certainly whatever truth it had kind of stopped with legalization. There really wasn't, you know, the people who did want to abuse a system for folks who needed it, you know, have moved to a market and can be a little more open about the fact that they want it. And that's, you know, why they're purchasing cannabis.
Before we get out of here, can you just tell us how folks can learn more about your work?
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to encourage people to show up to LCB meetings. whether that's in person or online. And you can email your state officials about cannabis policies or ideas. They're collecting hundreds of millions of dollars from consumers, but we don't speak up all that much. It's never a one and done thing when you want government to change, but it can happen. And also Washington Normal's chapter has a kind of short list of regular volunteers. So patients or consumers that want to be involved in learning a little more about good cannabis policy or how they can be advocates in their own lives, definitely encouraged to reach out to me, or also to kevin@wanormal.org. That's WANORML.ORG. And then definitely follow me on Facebook. You can also find me at Guy Named Bailey on Twitter, if that's working. And please follow my work at Cannabis Observer. You know, thank you so much for inviting me over, and really appreciated the opportunity.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Advocates for Medical Cannabis. Learn more about this organization at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com. Okay, so now it's on to our It's a Bust segment. And this is the part of the show where we talk about the drug war and what's going on with cannabis arrests out there. And in this case, we're down at the border. We seem to do a lot of these at the border down in Brownsville, Texas. And this was three men. They were hauling 157 pounds in bales across the border. And just so happens the sheriff drove up on them.
Yeah, sheriffs and Border Patrol caught them taking huge bales, three huge bales totaling 157 pounds across the border, and they got caught, and all of them got arrested. It's unfortunate. And, you know, this is something that we had hoped that the legal cannabis industry, if not, you know, through legal means, if it maybe through diversion, would eliminate the need for international drug smuggling across the U.S. border. But that's proven not to be true for a number of reasons.
Yeah, we would hope we'd get to a place, and I feel like this even with immigration, that you could like walk up to a kiosk or some type of building at the border and say, hey, I have some cannabis that I grew in Mexico, and you have a fair trade system to actually sell the cannabis in the United States without any fear of repercussion. Same thing with immigration. I feel like if you want to immigrate to the United States, you should have a kiosk where you go up to it, do a little thing, and you just walk into the country with your pass or whatever you have. But they just make this so difficult. They're put that border there. They're always arresting people. And one of the things that I found not interesting but sad about this is they just take them and put them in the United States Detention Center. What that is doing no good for anyone. It's just ruining their life, putting them in prison, spending more money, continuing the drug war. Nothing for society comes out good about the whole process.
No, it's really, it doesn't help anybody. I mean, and honestly, like let's say you want to stop drugs coming into the country. Maybe they shouldn't have detained these gentlemen. Maybe you just cease to take the bales. It seems like the level of violence for the offense is disproportionate.
Yeah, it's over the top.
They're smuggling hippie tomatoes across the border. They're smuggling plant matter across a border that's most likely not going to hurt anyone. And then they're taking it away and they're detaining these individuals for, you know, a long time. I'm going to assume this is two felonies, right? They're charging them with not only international drug smuggling, but they're also charging them with organized crime.
Yeah, that was the other one.
And so they're going to be in jail for at least 10 years, I'm guessing. And that over three bales of brown, I can't see the cannabis. I can just see the bales. I'm assuming it's not the highest quality. And it's just, it's a shame. It's a shame on so many levels. These guys are most likely working class individuals or just trying to make a buck. They're not smuggling people. They're smuggling cannabis. Like, I don't think the punishment is ever going to fit the crime on this. And I think Texas needs to legalize and lower the penalties on cannabis possessions if they even want to be taken seriously as a humane state. I mean, obviously, they don't want to be taken seriously as a humane or sane state. Just look at their experiences the past two winters with their grid or any other thing they've been doing, paving over all the swamps in Houston and then wondering why it floods.
Yeah, and I just wanted to throw in there that brickweed is going out to Houston, Dallas, Mobile, Atlanta, all the way across the Southeast. And in fact, I would say it was helping some people because when I was using medical cannabis in Alabama, it was all brickweed, and I'm guessing mostly from Mexico. So, right. And that really helped me through my 20s get through college, deal with a lot of personal issues because I'm blind. So, in fact, those folks are actually helping people in a lot of places in the United States where cannabis is illegal, and all you can get is this Delta 8 garbage. So, I feel like these guys, like you said, they're working class folks. I mean, they should not be detained, and I'd say give them a medal, but that's just me. Dig, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I also want to thank our guest for coming on, and I really appreciate everybody out there listening on the radio and our podcast and in the library. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a great week, Dig.
You too. See you next time, Lucas.
If you have questions or would like to comment on the show, you can reach us at thecannabiscorner840@gmail.com. To listen to back episodes or to subscribe to the show, find us all across the internet by searching The Cannabis Corner. How can folks get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast, The Bagseed Chronicles, wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you to Radio Tacoma and KTQA for their continued support. I'd also like to thank Aaron Foles for his production assistance. And finally, thank you for joining us on The Cannabis Corner.